Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. The influx of immigrants from the Middle East to Greece continues, with about 100 to 500 landing on the Greek island of Kos every day, joining thousands already camped there. Greece has been overwhelmed by the wave of refugees and economic migrants, mostly from Syria, with more than 125,000 of them reaching the eastern Aegean islands this year. That's a 750% increase as compared to 2014. Speaking to reporters Wednesday in Brussels, the European Commission spokeswoman Natasha Bertaud said that the situation in Greece, particularly in Kos, is very serious, and the EU is working with several refugee agencies, primarily with its border management agency, to assist. The Islamic State Egyptian affiliate claimed Wednesday that it has beheaded a Croatian it abducted last month, showing a purported photo of his body in an online message. The state-run Croatian news agency, HINA, said it could not confirm that Tomislav Salopek, a married 30-year-old father of two who was working in Egypt, had been killed. If confirmed, his beheading would be the first of a Western hostage held by the Sinai province, that is, an Egyptian group that has pledged its allegiance to the Islamic State. Syrian activists said government airstrikes Wednesday near Damascus killed at least 27 people. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said the strikes hit several towns in the eastern Ghouta region and also left at least 120 people wounded. The airstrikes followed shelling in Damascus by rebel fighters that the observatory said killed at least one person and wounded 20 others. This is VOA News. Greek lawmakers are finishing a draft bill for the country's third government bailout package in 5 years. They're aiming for a vote before a meeting of Eurozone ministers on Friday. Lawmakers were finishing the draft on Wednesday, with a vote expected on Thursday. On Tuesday, Greece and its international creditors agreed in principle on broad terms of a new bailout. Greece needs the money by August 20th. That's when it must repay about $3.5 billion in debt to the European Central Bank. China has allowed the value of its currency to drop for a second consecutive day. It repeats a surprise move on Tuesday that rattled global markets and could raise tensions with its trade competitors. The Chinese yuan's value fell 1.6% on Wednesday after falling nearly 2% a day earlier, which was its biggest single-day drop in a decade. That surprise devaluation of China's currency has created a ripple effect through commodities as well as currencies and stock prices in Asian emerging markets. VOA's correspondent Steve Herman reports.
Broad indexes of Asian stocks, excluding the Japan market, plunged 2% Wednesday to a two-year low, a day after the yuan's trading band was loosened, resulting in about a 5% slide of the currency in global trading. Vietnam followed suit and widened the trading band around the dong. Glenn McGuire, chief Asia-Pacific economist at ANZ Bank, says other Asian governments may also be tempted to weaken their currencies.
If Thailand, Indonesia, Malaysia, Vietnam all decided they were going to win or gain market share by making their currencies significantly cheaper, then it's their average citizens who pay the cost of that policy decision.
Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says it's very likely that his emails are read by the Chinese and Russians, both of whom have been accused of recent cyber attacks on U.S. government targets. It's very likely and not outside the realm of possibility, said Kerry when he spoke about the matter Tuesday during an interview on CBS Evening News. We know that they have attacked a number of American interests, he said, over the course of the last few days. A spokesman for Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton said Tuesday that she's turning over a private email server that she used to send and receive messages during her tenure as U.S. Secretary of State to the Justice Department. Clinton has been pressured by Republican lawmakers to relinquish the server ever since it was revealed back in March that she used her personal email account to send official messages. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The more we build, the faster people come for shelter. We can't separate families. We can't tell people. We can't turn them away.
That's International Organization for Migration spokesperson Joelle Millman. Details coming up. Also in the news, an estimated 50 people have died in a bomb explosion in a town in Nigeria's Borno state. Cameroon tightens public security amid attacks by Boko Haram. And the U.S. condemns yesterday's bombing attack in Borno state. We have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Burundi, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story this hour, the International Organization for Migration, IOM, says aid agencies are racing to cope with the rapid influx of thousands of internally displaced South Sudanese at the UN compound in Malakal, Upper Nile State. Lisa Schlein reports from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Since mid-July, more than 16,000 people have fled to the UN site in Malakal for protection and assistance. Nearly 10,700 have arrived since August 1st. International Organization for Migration spokesman Joelle Millman tells VOA, this heavy influx of new arrivals is creating a chaotic and untenable situation for both the displaced and the aid agencies trying to help them. Millman notes the camp, which was designed for 18,000, now houses 46,500 internally displaced. And this number, he says, is rapidly rising as almost 1,000 new people are arriving every day.
So we can imagine that tents are overcrowded, that the passageways between tents are being filled with sort of impromptu settlements, that sanitation is now a huge concern because people relieve themselves very close to their drinking water supply, which we have to maintain in some manner.
In addition to these already challenging conditions, Millman says aid agencies now have to cope with impending rains. He says this will worsen the already desperate living conditions in the improvised settlements and make it more difficult to provide assistance. He says IOM is doing what it can to provide services to new arrivals, but he says the current influx is unprecedented, and the heavy rains, together with increasing congestion, are adding to the collective misery. He says the UN mission in South Sudan and humanitarian agencies are working to provide additional space to shelter families in dry areas. But he says this will not solve the problem of overcrowding.
The more we build, the faster people come for shelter. We can't separate families. We can't tell people. We can't turn them away. On the other hand, we can't expose them to what could be extremely dangerous health conditions. If you don't do proper drainage, I mean, what diseases are you attracting? Can you have a new tent city that becomes a flooded tent city? And how do you deliver to that?
Millman says operations are underway to provide safe drinking water and sanitation. He says IOM is digging emergency pit latrines, though not enough to meet demand. Humanitarian agencies have been unable to provide aid to communities in areas surrounding Malakal for months because of the conflict. This is behind much of the current exodus. To stem the flow of new arrivals into Malakal, the agencies agree they must be allowed to distribute relief immediately to these underserved populations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
An estimated 50 people have died in a bomb explosion in a town in Nigeria's Borno state. Meanwhile, across the Nigerian border, Cameroon claims to have killed 10 Boko Haram militants who attacked the town of Ashigashiya. The explosion yesterday in a market in Sabongari in Nigeria has been condemned by the U.S. State Department. No one has claimed responsibility for the bombing. Boko Haram has killed thousands during a violent six-year campaign to establish an Islamic State in northeastern Nigeria. Thousands of civilians have died and more than 1.5 million displaced by the violence. There have been delays in the coordination of a regional coalition of more than 8,000 troops from five nations to put a stop to the Boko Haram campaign, which has spread to neighboring nations. Cameroonians are learning to cope with the many security checks in their country after the government heavily deployed its military to all major towns to search people, goods, shops and houses as Boko Haram terrorism fear grips the country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
A soldier gives search orders at the main train station in Yaoundé. It is the first time travelers are asked to line up and pass through metal detectors before having access to the train in Cameroon. Soldier Suzanne Gam says Cameroon's government deployed them in response to four Boko Haram suicide bombings that occurred in northern Cameroon last month.
Here we search everybody. We search the customers, we search the employers. And also among us, our colleagues that work in the night, when we came in the morning, they search our bags. We also search them when they are going out because of this problem of Boko Haram that we have in hand.
Businessman Emmanuel Ngufo, who is traveling to northern Cameroon, says although the checks have led to delays, he salutes the initiative.
It's for our security. We can never tell, judging from the looks of people. So it may be inconveniencing, but in as much as we know that it's for our good, it is worth it.
Last month, about 60 Cameroonians were killed in the Central African nation's northern border area with Nigeria's Borno State, a stronghold of the Boko Haram terrorist group. The insurgents used teenage female suicide bombers in the four attacks. Bernard Okalia Bilai, governor of southwestern Cameroon, says although the attacks were in the north, the government of Cameroon has asked them to increase checks all over the country.
In the church, in the market. If you suspect a face, don't hesitate to ask the man who he is without any provocation, without any threat, without any violence. Say, please, sir, can I know who you are? Me, I'm Mr. X. It may bring some disturbances within the population, but it's the price to pay.
Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Alemebengo, says he has also instructed business persons, schools and churches to recruit private security agents.
C'est vraiment une action d'ensemble.
He says security forces have been working hard, but they need the support of every Cameroonian. He says everyone should be educated to contribute in fighting Boko Haram until it is totally eliminated from Cameroon. He says Cameroon will underdevelop into an emerging economy when there is peace. Boko Haram, which was founded in northern neighboring Nigeria, has vowed to attack Cameroon because the country has supported the Nigerian military's mission to defeat the group. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The International Organization for Migration, IOM, is increasing reinforcement of Liberia's cross-border screening of travelers and its surveillance capacity for Ebola. The new project is being funded by USAID's Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. No new cases of Ebola have been reported in Liberia. However, ongoing transmission of the virus continues in neighboring Sierra Leone and Guinea. IOM has been working with other disease prevention organizations and Liberia's Ministry of Health. Their objective is to ensure early detection of imported cases and the identification, tracking, and monitoring of potential high-risk contacts. Salvatore Sortina is the IOM Chief of Mission for Liberia. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis about the need for expanding cross-border training to combat the spread of Ebola.
Liberia is a country with very high cross-border mobility. As you know, we are in a situation where Liberia is at the town of about 2 weeks before laboratory while we still have active transmission in the neighboring country, particularly Guinea and Sierra Leone. Based on this, it's the priority of the Ministry of Health to ensure that a certain level of surveillance is established and maintained at the borders. And the borders of Liberia present particular challenges in the sense that they are very porous. We have some 47 total official ports of entry, but over 150 unofficial crossing points where there is regular movement of population. So in order to increase surveillance, and screening has been identified as one of the measures to be put in place, particularly in port of entry, so official crossing points.
What is IOM's role in this special project or in this new project?
IOM has been supporting already border surveillance, active screening, as well as community engagement in one of the counties, which is Grand Cape Mount, at the beginning of the year. Through this new project, IOM intends to build capacity of the local actors in port of entry, as well as engaging with communities to build their capacity to conduct basically surveillance. Now this would be through three main different components. One of the most important is supporting coordination at the county level. So because of the nature of the border that I was mentioning before, it is essential that the identification of specific targets, like which area requires particular attention, is identified at a very local level. This requires that there is a coordination system at the county level, already established in the previous months, but needs to be supported. So IOM intends to support this by establishing a presence in key counties, although the project will cover all the border counties, and then conduct training of the actors which are involved in this coordination system, particularly the county health teams, who will have focal points for border coordination in terms of surveillance. This would be our first component, so supporting county health teams and coordination system at the ground level. Then there is a component for building the capacity of border actors, particularly these would be the Bureau of Immigration, who are often in many ports of entry the only official presence who manage migration, as well as county health team and Ministry of Health for those ports of entry who also have port health, where there is an official Ministry of Health presence at the port of entry. The idea is to basically conduct training of trainers on safe entry and exit screening procedures as SOPs agreed by the Ministry of Health.
What is actually involved in the training?
Till now, an orientation training conducted by IOM for the official port of entry, but also other partners for what regards the community event-based surveillance, an effort conducted by a coordination group that has been established in Monrovia, which is named Border Coordination Group. Also the definition of training guidelines for basically conducting safe screening and supporting the development of contingency plans. So what happens at the port of entry in case there is somebody, a traveler, that is detected with fever or with symptoms that are associated to TB, and now this will have to be scaled up to other diseases, so to be integrated in the general disease surveillance system. So the training guidelines, this is one actually of the achievement or one of the output of the project, will have to be revised in coordination with the central effort of the Ministry of Health.
What is the status of the cases of Ebola in Sierra Leone and Guinea at this point?
The last one was probably the lowest with number of cases, so it is going very well. At the moment, we don't have any area around Liberia with active transmission. So all cases are concentrated in provinces that are not bordering Liberia. Nevertheless, know that due to economic linkages and relations, there is a lot of travel from the different capitals, and therefore we expect that there will be movement, and for these reasons that not connect just the areas that border each other. Right? So the type of movements that we intend to cover through this project is not just the normal cross-bordering movement that regards the communities that live at the border and continuously go back and forth for different relations, but also the long travels that are connected more to economic relation and trade and so forth.
How long is this project expected to go on?
The project is expected to go on until June. One last component, which is the one that will last longer and will require an important monitoring function, is actually the third component, which is engagement with communities. Because of the nature of the borders and the fact that the majority of crossing points are not actually official crossing points, it is essential that we have a close engagement with the communities, which are more impacted by this high mobility. The strategy of the Ministry of Health is to basically roll out in all counties, not just borders, basically in roll out in every county community event-based surveillance. This is basically to engage through community health workers with the communities
to make sure that they are trained in how to report according to triggers that are established by the Ministry of Health. So these projects will target by engaging with community-based organizations to make sure that they can provide regular monitoring of these in areas that are actually having a quite remote access and therefore require regular monitoring to make sure that we are able to give information according to the system.
That was Salvatore Sortini, IOM Chief of Mission for Liberia. He spoke with my colleague Kim Lewis from Monrovia. 20 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. South Africa's new visa regulations are deterring visitors, with some analysts estimating a loss of nearly $133 million this year in the tourist industry. Gillian Parker reports from Johannesburg that South African President Jacob Zuma says the government will review the new requirements that have caused public clashes within the ruling party.
Regulations implemented last year that require South African visitors to provide biometric data in person when applying for tourist visas have been problematic in large countries like China, where only Beijing and Shanghai have South African consulates. Spending $165 billion globally in 2014, Chinese tourists are some of the world's biggest spenders. As one of the largest outbound tourism markets in the world, South Africa has invested heavily in marketing toward China. Grant Thornton Advisory Services Company Development Director Liam Back says the number of Chinese visitors to South Africa increased 15% in 2013. But when new visa requirements were implemented, demand dropped by more than 45%.
So what's happened is that the tour operators have turned around and said, you're making it too difficult for us to travel to your country. It has absolutely had an impact on our tourism industry. And the obstacles have just become too huge. And we say, okay, well, let's just go somewhere else.
Regulations introduced in June also stipulate minors must carry their full or unabridged birth certificate when crossing South Africa's borders. Biometrics and unabridged birth certificates are largely lacking in developing countries. Poor communication about the new requirements has caused confusion and uncertainty for prospective tourists. As a result, South African travel packages are being removed from various catalogues, says Tourism Business Council of South Africa CEO Majaji Ramawela.
You're trying to kill a mosquito with a sledgehammer. Where is the real problem? It's your porous land borders. And they're just putting this regulation because according to them, this is how it's going to solve the problem. It's not solving the problem. We tend to do quick fixes and it's hurting. We're really, really, really hurting an industry that has been doing good.
The new birth certificate rules fueled a rare public dispute within the ruling African National Congress Party at a time when President Jacob Zuma is battling lethargic economic growth and a crippling energy crisis. Tourism Minister Derek Hanekom said last month the rules need to be changed, provoking a backlash from Home Affairs Minister Malusi Gigaba, who argued that they were needed to curtail child trafficking. While human trafficking has to be tackled, many agree this tactic is not the most effective, when traffickers usually adopt clandestine and illegal means to smuggle people in and out of the country. At a mid-year national address Tuesday, President Zuma said a ministerial committee would address the unintended consequences of the new immigration regulations on various sectors, including tourism and investment. Many say the government must act swiftly to mitigate the damage already done to the industry. Gillian Parker, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Associated Press Wire Service says South African officials are reporting record numbers of rhinoceros being slaughtered by poachers. South Africa is the home of most of the world's rhinos. The government's Environment Ministry reports more than 1,200 killed in 2014. Environment Minister Edna Molewa says in the first 4 months of this year, 393 were killed, a jump of 20% over the same period last year. A group called Outraged South African Citizens Against Poaching says The figures do not include calves who die when their mothers are killed by poachers. South Africa has struggled to contain illegal poaching syndicates that are meeting rising demand for their horns in parts of Asia, including Vietnam. 4 years, insecurity has remained one of the major challenges facing inhabitants of major towns and cities in Africa. But in Kenya's vast Rift Valley region, a local leader has become a household name for using Twitter to fight crime and enhance safety in the area. Francis Karuki, 50, a chief and government-appointed administrator, is embracing the new technology to address carjacking, burglaries, and theft. From Nakuru in Kenya's Rift Valley, correspondent Ruben Kiyama reports.
And if their chicken is lost, they call me chief. My chicken is lost, put it in Twitter, but they don't know what is Twitter. They know Twitter is chief's message. They don't know what is Twitter, but they know. Rather put in Twitter.
That's Chief Kariuki, popularly known as the Tweeting Chief. He is the local government administrator in charge of Umoja Lanet in Nakuru County. Citizens are impressed by his use of the social media for combating crime in his community. Chief Kariuki boasts, saying that he has been able to reduce theft, carjacking, and burglary.
So when I send a message out, they are either stolen a car or they are breaking to somebody's house. What they do is they run away because they know they have been discovered. We have recovered, carjacked, they just dropped them. Another day they were stealing a transformer here. And people told me, oh, Baraka is the transformer. Is being stolen. I sent a message out and this guy jumped from the top and ran away.
Chief Kariuki, a former teacher for over 20 years, started using Twitter in May 2011 to help make local people aware of crime and other issues. He quit teaching to pursue his newfound passion as a public servant. He felt he could serve more people as a chief than as a teacher.
It's a requirement that every administrator like me or every chief to have 2 public balazas in a month to address different issues. For example, maybe there was an outbreak of polio, or maybe like today we have the free medical camp. So it was getting hard for me to be able to communicate and call people to come for these meetings.
He says that communicating to the locals was a major challenge, and this prompted him to look for an alternative method to relay information to the people of Umoja Lanet.
Luckily, I was able to come across Twitter website and look for tweeting through SMS. From there, life was never the same again.
The tweeting chief says that Twitter has come in handy at a time when he had challenges communicating to the elderly and locals who have little understanding of the social media. He says that one does not need to have a smartphone or internet connection to access his messages. All his people are able to get his messages immediately he sends in any type of mobile phone.
Even the cheapest phone, they don't need to have any sort of internet. It is SMS-based. So that's why when I saw how it works, my next thing was now, how do I connect with the citizen? What in Kenya you call mamamboga, those people who do not have any sort of phones, the internet-enabled phones or smartphones. So 8988 solved the whole problem. That code, because it converts tweet into text message. And they can also be able to follow me through text message.
For a man who wears many hats, like Chief Kariuki, the work has not been an easy feat. He is not only a man of the people, but also a father and a husband. You might wonder what language the chief uses to send his information to more than 15,000 people, some educated while others are illiterate. Well, this is what he has to say.
And I write the simplest language they can understand. If their chicken is lost, they call me chief. My chicken is lost, put it in Twitter. But they don't know what is Twitter. They know Twitter is chief's message. They don't know what is Twitter.
For Chief Kariuki's admirers, Umoja Lanet is a safe haven thanks to one man's curiosity for technology and passion for public service. Reporting for VOA News, this is Ruben Chama in Nakuru.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyu Suhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is African News Tonight on The Voice of America. Here is a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The International Organization for Migration says aid agencies are racing to cope with the rapid influx of thousands of internally displaced South Sudanese. And an estimated 50 people have died in a bomb explosion in a town in Nigeria's Borno state. Coming up, music from Burundi, and in our feature segment, the second year of President Barack Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the sunny side of sports with Jonah Haskell. Hello, Jonah.
Hello, Yehiz.
What is on the sports menu this evening?
We begin today with the UEFA Super Cup, which has a new champion. FC Barcelona defeated Sevilla FC Tuesday in the competition that pits the winners of the UEFA Champions League and the UEFA Europa League against each other. Played in Tbilisi, the capital of the small former Soviet Republic of Georgia, the game became an instant classic as both teams combined to score 9 goals, created multiple lead changes, and needed extra time to decide a winner. Sevilla got off to a bright start in the third minute when Ever Banega curled a free kick over the wall and into the goal from about 20 yards out. Barcelona keeper Ter Stegen didn't even move as he had no chance at making the save, but the Catalans' magic man Lionel Messi would get them back on terms just 4 minutes later when the Argentine responded with a free kick goal that was near identical to Banega's. Messi had more magic up his sleeve in the 15th minute when he scored on another free kick, this time from over 25 yards away. His rocket of a shot left Sevilla's keeper Beto with no chance to make the save as it went in off the inside of the post to give Barca a 2-1 lead. The reigning La Liga champs would add another goal just before halftime when Luis Suarez's cross was knocked in at point-blank range by Rafinha to make it 3-1. Barcelona seemed to have the game in the bag just after halftime, when Sergio Busquets stole the ball deep in Sevilla's half and threaded a pass through to Luis Suarez, who finished to make it 4-1. Sevilla still had some fight in them, though, as Jose Antonio Reyes got a goal back in the 57th minute, and then Gamero buried a penalty to make it a 4-3 game with 18 minutes to go. Yevhen Konoplyanka completed the comeback in the 81st minute when he tucked in a cross from Ciro Immobile to tie the game at 4-4. Neither team would score for the next 35 minutes as the game went into extra time, but with just 5 minutes left before penalties would decide the winner, we got a goal as Lionel Messi's free kick ricocheted back to him off the wall, and his second shot got through to Beto, who spilled the ball in front of him. It was just the opening that recent substitute Pedro was looking for as he pounced on the ball and stuck it in the back of the net to give Barcelona a 5-4 win and their fifth UEFA Super Cup. Pedro is set to leave Barcelona this season after spending his entire career with the club. Lionel Messi spoke after the match about the departure of his friend and teammate and also about the thrill of winning another trophy.
I'm very happy because Pedro scored the winner. Personally, I don't know what he's going to decide, but we will support him whatever he decides. We wish him the best as he has delivered and is still delivering many things to Barcelona. He deserves the best. I don't know his decision, but whatever it is, he'll have our support. It is always a beautiful thing to lift trophies. The more honours, the better. This particular trophy was very important because of the significance of this competition and because we had to start the season well. We gave this title a lot of importance because for this group, every single title is beautiful and a great achievement.
Contento y todos los títulos son lindos y importantes de poder conseguir.
Barcelona's manager Luis Enrique also spoke about the strength of their opponents and the resilience of his own team.
When you're leading 4-1, the opponent has nothing to lose. Obviously, we have to analyze what happened and the risk that Sevilla took. They managed to come back. It happens sometimes. They had a penalty and used the wings. It was the same last season in La Liga. We were leading 2-0 and finally they drew the game. Today it happened again in a final, but we can't forget Sevilla's strength. It seems Barcelona is expected to win every title, but it's not always like this. What we did has a lot of merit, so I'm very proud of how the players managed to restart again when it was 4-4 and create new chances.
Con 4-4 volvemos a rehacernos y volvemos a generar ocasiones.
Sevilla begins their La Liga season against Malaga on Friday, August 21st, and Barcelona begins their campaign against Athletic 2 days later. Kick it.
I'm Shegun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports, from the Africa Service of the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on!
The VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma joins us now with sports news from all over the continent, and I believe he's beginning today with netball.
Malawi edged Uganda 59-53, Trinidad and Tobago beat Zambia 66-39, and South Africa dismissed Wales 68-40 at the Netball World Cup in Sydney, Australia on Tuesday. Today, Wednesday, Zambia challenged Samoa. Malawi face New Zealand as South Africa encounter Australia. In handball, Qatar edged Algeria 24-21, Iceland pipped Egypt 31-29, while France outplayed Tunisia 34-24 at the Men's Youth World Handball Championships in Yekaterinburg, Russia on Tuesday. Today, Wednesday, Egypt play Venezuela as Algeria encounter Switzerland. Turning to football, former International Olympic Committee IOC Director General Francois Carrard of Switzerland is to head the FIFA Task Force on Reforms, the World Football Governing Body FIFA disclosed on Tuesday. The 2016 FIFA Reform Committee Carrard will chair include two representatives from each of FIFA's six confederations. The committee will crystallize reform proposals to be presented for approval at the FIFA Extraordinary Elective Congress in Zurich, Switzerland on the 26th of February next year. It is at this meeting that a new FIFA president will be elected to replace incumbent Joseph Sepp Blatter. On the 2nd June, Blatter declared he would step down from office barely a week after being re-elected to a fifth term. His unexpected decision came in the wake of unprecedented scandal and corruption allegations that have tarnished FIFA's image. Karad is credited with guiding the IOC through its reforms following the scandal in the bidding process for the 2002 Salt Lake City Winter Olympics.
Thank you very much. That's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. We move now to Toronto, where the Canadian Open is underway. After much of Monday's schedule was rained out, players were able to get in most of their matches Tuesday, although there was still some inclement weather. That weather prevented world number three Andy Murray from finishing his second round match against Spain's Tommy Rebredo. The match was stopped during the first set, with the score tied at four games apiece. It will be finished later on Wednesday. Several other big names were able to play full matches, though. World number one Novak Djokovic defeated Tomas Belucci of Brazil in a close two-setter, 6-3, 7-6, to advance to the third round. Before his match, Djokovic spoke about his season so far and how he used the short break after Wimbledon to prepare for the upcoming hardcourt season.
Well, my goals are obviously to play the best tennis on the biggest events, Grand Slams and, you know, the thousand events. Well, this is one of them, and I needed to take some time off, and, you know, resting and recalibrating is as important as the work that you do. So knowing that and having that in the back of mind allows me to balance myself right, spend some time with the family, as I said, reflecting on a great 6 months of this season that have been really probably the best 6 months that I had. Next to that season in 2011, and hopefully I can ride on that wave of confidence that I had even in the next half of the season.
Eight seed Milos Raonic lost to the unseeded Ivo Karlovic in a very close match, 7-6, 7-6, and South African Kevin Anderson had a disappointing early exit as he lost his first round match to Lucas Rosol, but it was a very tight match that saw Anderson lose 7-6, 7-6. Also, American John Isner defeated Germany's Benjamin Becker, and Belgium's David Goffin beat American Steve Johnson, while Australian Nick Kyrgios also advanced after beating Spain's Fernando Verdasco 6-4, 4-6, 6-4. On the women's side, world number one Serena Williams lost the first set of her match against Italian Flavia Panetta, but came back strong to lose only three games over the final two sets to win the match 2-6, 6-3, 6-0. Serena now moves on to the third round, where she will take on the winner of the match between Heather Watson and Andrea Petkovic. That will be played later today. 10th seed Karolina Pliskova also advanced after she beat Mirjana Lucic-Baroni in three sets, 6-3, 6-7, 6-2. And Swiss 12th seed Timea Baksinski was bounced out of the tournament by American Allison Risk, who won the final two sets of a very tough match, 3-6, 7-6, 7-6. Finally, Victoria Azarenka made short work of Elena Svitolina in a 6-1, 6-4 win that sent Azarenka to the second round. The second and third rounds will continue Thursday from Toronto, Canada. And that does it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell. Back to Yehaeus Wuhib.
Thank you, Jonah. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Friday, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 UTC right here on The Voice of America. Coming up, the second year of President Barack Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. And next, xenophobia in South Africa. But first, some music. It is Kidum of Burundi with Abambuzi.
Homme d'affaires, Gango Yusuf Matoma, Yahya Hussein, Papa Grace, Charles Ogada, Digital Entertainment Promotion. Ah, c'est ça. Mama Kibido. Morisoyano. Todie, todie.
Supamo ansama si joro. Supamo wisera. Kandi wajiwa mamoko. Itewa kensi na mungu samara. Itumwa kensi niki ya babu. Tamarongo mesi.
Neka bi zosa ya amuwa Ugasigara witoka wichuza Kwesiyo minya kanura mushinga nage Kanura mufasoni Yisi siwe nyigise Abano boni batifina Abambuzi tabara bufise Abutera kesu titekwiye
Papa Grasso Wami maso kumbuzika mituna jawe
Kari ukinomu
Kumbera makabanu jambo mokondo razasi
Wirinde
Wirinde, wirinda bambuzi
Bambuzi, bambuzi nyonyo
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Mutko abiri yakuya
Muse wigeru ya yata
Mutko awe ni mana
Muse wigeru tuancho antoko
Umbiri sanchuti anje umugishu tangwa ni mana Babambuzi basa kwisi nafkari baruse nyanzu kibusa Ulivyo rero rujamu mokono razusi Ineka bizosa ya pwe nikute kukia unye Kanuramu singa na ye Kanuramu fazoni Yisi simi nyigisi Ama nubo nima kifina Ama muzi tavara wafise Ama tera kesu titekwe
Mokurinda bambuzi
Akati arete kawagasema
Wami maso mbuzi na mituna jawe
Kandi kabiri karatiko
Mera makabalu jambo mokono razasi
Heza mwibuza
Wirinde, wirinda bambuzi
Aho
Wirinde, wirinda basura, basura, basura
Imitwe, tirarira Sikuza, sikuza, sikuza
Tambu kwe dengwe
Kidum of Burundi with Abambuzi. In its second year, President Barack Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative welcomed dozens of young Africans as Mandela Washington Fellows. They came to the U.S. for 6 weeks of study at U.S. universities and a summit meeting with President Obama in Washington, D.C. One such fellow is Gabriel Hussein Khan from South Africa. He's a young activist from South Africa who uses art to give voice to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender community in his country.
My name is Gabriel Hussein Khan. I'm from South Africa, and I'm on the civic leadership track at Tulane University. I coordinate a project working with LGBTI youth in Southern Africa, and through this project, we use creative methods like visual art, interactive drama, and creative writing to empower LGBTI youth in the Southern African region. So art is useful for two reasons. Firstly, it creates a space where young people can talk about the experience and talk about their feelings and their challenges in life. And secondly, it becomes a way for young people to be more visible through their artworks and through their stories. One of the challenges we have as young leaders on the African continent is while we might be inspired to create change in our communities, we don't have all the skills or capabilities. And I thought this would be an opportunity to strengthen my capabilities as a leader.
2015, how much
we have remained? While in New Orleans, I've been based at the Institute for Women and Ethnic Studies, which is a group of individuals doing work around women of color here in New Orleans. And in a way, what I appreciate about their work is they tie together two struggles that I think are connected, both here in the US and in South Africa, the issue of gender and gender injustice, but also the issue of race and racism, which is another problem. And in many ways, it echoes with the experience we have back home. It's interesting to note that some of the challenges we have in cities like Johannesburg are similar to the challenges people experience in New Orleans. In a way, Katrina here was sort of like apartheid in South Africa, and it was a disaster, and we're responding to it as people here are.
There is no country in the world where slavery happened where they have so many thousands of testimonies of people who endured slavery.
Today I visited the Whitney Museum, and it reminded me of the long histories of oppression people of color have experienced here in the US, but also in South Africa, I guess.
And oftentimes, the name of the mother is missing because the children were already orphans.
I think it's important to learn about the history of oppression so that history can inform our current interventions. I think that this is not just about slavery, though. It's about other forms of oppression as well. I think it's linked to gender injustice and even homophobia and transphobia. I hope to take home from Yali the connections I've made with other African leaders, the people on the program, learning about the experiences from their countries. I think this is really useful because these are the future leaders of organizations and even possibly countries. And I think through building on those connections, we can really strengthen the future of Africa.
That was Gabriel Hossein Khan, a Mandela Fellow from South Africa. Millions of Zimbabweans are facing serious xenophobia in South Africa. Over the years, the diaspora has endured abuse at the hands of South African employers, South African police, and the Department of Immigration. Reporter Benedict Inalfo recently spoke to some expatriate Zimbabweans in South Africa to find out why they would risk xenophobic attacks rather than return home.
The term xenophobia scares millions of foreigners, including Zimbabweans living in South Africa. Some of them witnessed the killing of 62 people in 2008 and recent xenophobic attacks that left 7 people dead and thousands homeless. Some South Africans claim that foreigners are grabbing all jobs and operating businesses which are supposed to be for locals. Despite these sad memories, most Zimbabweans have vowed to stay put in South Africa, saying there is no democracy in their homeland. Dumisani Leah, who has lived in South Africa for many years, says to make matters worse, the Zimbabwean economy is almost collapsing.
Dying from xenophobia is a better way of dying than dying at the hands of the Zimbabwean government. Death has never stopped people from seeking a better life, because they are looking for better economic opportunities. So the solution to the whole thing of Zimbabweans coming to South Africa is by improving the economic situation in Zimbabwe.
Hundreds of Zimbabweans left South Africa following xenophobic attacks in 2008 and sometime this year. Arnold Ngala says the majority of his colleagues who fled the attacks are now back in South Africa.
When they go back, they find that the situation is still the same. It's still unstable. So they see themselves again, coming back again to South Africa. So even if there can be 2 million people that can be killed and 2 million can go back to Zimbabwe, as long as the situation does not change, the same 2 million are going to come and risk being killed this side, because there is a higher opportunity of living this side than on the other side of the border.
Ngala says lack of jobs and general freedom will force them to stay in South Africa.
Even if people go back, it's not like they want to come back to South Africa. But the environment that they found themselves into, the instability of the politics and the instability of the economic situation is forcing them, because people have to survive. So now, if people are finding the environment not conducive for them to survive, they are forced naturally. It is a natural thing to look for greener pastures.
Big Foster Nkomose echoes the same sentiments, noting that their lives entirely depend on Zimbabwe's ruling elite.
They come silently underground because they're running away from government, corruption and everything. We know there's no clean government, but they need to try. Not even an animal can live there. There's animals that you can't find anymore.
With Zimbabwe now rated by some organizations as one of the world's poorest countries after 35 years of self-rule, most Zimbabweans say only fate will determine their destiny. Reporting in Johannesburg, this is Benedictine Hlapo.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. On behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Werkinger, and our engineer, Nelson Lopes, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The 69th session of the United Nations General Assembly adopted a resolution on July 30th committing countries to step up their collected efforts to address wildlife crime and put an end to the global wildlife trafficking crisis. The resolution was co-sponsored by the United States, Gabon, Germany, and more than 80 other nations. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Director Dan Ash commended the United Nations General Assembly for its action. The UN resolution encourages countries to adopt effective measures to prevent and counter the serious problem of crimes that have an impact on the environment, such as trafficking in wildlife and wildlife products, as well as poaching. Action along the entire trade chain is encouraged, with member states urged to treat wildlife trafficking involving organized criminal groups as a serious crime, implement anti-money laundering measures, establish national-level interagency wildlife crime task forces, strengthen judicial processes and law enforcement efforts, prevent and counter corruption, and reduce the demand for illegally traded wildlife products from protected species using targeted strategies in order to influence consumer behavior. The UN resolution also strongly encourages countries to develop sustainable and alternative livelihoods for communities affected by trafficking of wildlife, encouraging the full engagement of the communities in and adjacent to wildlife habitats as active partners in conservation and sustainable use. This action underscores the global commitment to the fight against the growing illegal wildlife trade and those who threaten the future of many of our planet's species, said Director Ash. As a world leader in wildlife and natural resources conservation, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is committed to working with others to reducing illegal demand, dismantling trafficking networks, and ensuring that wildlife thrives for future generations. Wildlife trafficking is a global problem that demands a global solution, and we need to act now if we are going to save elephants, rhinos, tigers, pangolins, and other iconic species, Director Ash warned. The service is proud to work with foreign governments, non-governmental organizations, the private sector, community leaders, and concerned citizens to achieve this goal. This resolution will serve as a valuable catalyst for strengthened actions across the globe to put an end to the poaching crisis.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, around the world, the killing of Zimbabwe's beloved Cecil the Lion angered people and highlighted sport hunting in Africa. On Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they examine trophy hunting and what can be done to protect endangered species like lions, elephants, and rhinos. That's next time on VOA Africa.